Movie buff specialist Phil and John are back with episode number 13, unlocking number 13. 13 straight weeks, though, for all of you. So I guess that makes you pretty damn lucky. But we are on to our 88th favorite movies of all time as we continue to count down our 100 favorite films of all time. Today, we are going to be talking about 2007's Atonement and 2018's Annihilation, the two movies on John and my list. However, before we get into that, since this is the top of the episode, I want to let everybody know now that tomorrow night, John and I are going to be recording an Oscar episode. So if you're listening to this on April 20th, as we're recording it, or on April 21st, the evening of, after we get done recapping the challenge, John and I are going to break down the Oscars, and we're going to do a little head-to-head against ourselves to see who gets the most right out of every category. So we're going to cover every single category. However, we're really only going to dive deep into the big 10, 11 categories: screenplays, best picture, acting, directing, and sound this year, which is a big category considering Sound of Metal came out. So that's what we're going to be doing tomorrow night. Just something a little bit fun since the Oscars are going to be this Sunday, something that's not in line with the top 100 movies, our favorite 100 movies, but something that movie fans are definitely excited about. Who would have thought we'd even get an Oscars? And the news today was, or maybe it came out yesterday, but at the Oscars, they don't have to wear masks while the camera is rolling. But once the camera stops rolling, they all are supposed to put their masks on. I love it. That sounds like science to me. Anyway, so we'll be able to see all their smiling, beautiful faces at the end of the day. That is the news for tomorrow. That's what we're going to be doing. But the more important thing is, number 88 on both of our lists, Atonement and Annihilation. John, was this the first time you had watched Atonement?
This was the first time I paid attention while watching Atonement. The first time I watched it, I was on an airplane to Paris at the age of, 16? And it was the middle of the night because it was a red-eye flight. So I definitely fell asleep during it.
So not really an authentic viewing of Atonement. This was probably about my 10th or 11th time watching Atonement. This was my third time watching Annihilation. Even though I that's why I can't believe that it's only came out in 2018. I feel like it's been around so much longer in my life because I don't feel like I've watched this movie every year. But I also think that kind of speaks to this movie, that even watching it once a year, as I have since it came out, because I didn't see it in theaters. So the first time I saw it was 2019. I watched it in 2020, and I just watched it again in 2021. Interesting that I have watched it pretty much once every year and it hasn't gotten old at all for me. I feel like it's actually gotten better on each viewing. How many times have you seen Annihilation?
This was my third time watching it as well. But I did see it in theaters, so.
Okay. See, so let's start with Annihilation and then we'll go to Atonement. Neither one of these movies is all that popular, but I feel like being that the Oscars are coming up, and we're going to be having the Oscars, we might as well talk about the Oscar movie last. And Annihilation was not an Oscar movie. More of a highbrow sci-fi drama here from Alex Garland. John, why does this one come in at number 88 on your list?
So I talked about it before. I love sci-fi movies. And I think Alex Garland is one of the best sci-fi directors right now. Him and Denis Villeneuve are by far the best sci-fi directors right now, and what they are producing is incredible. This was his follow-up to Ex Machina, another movie on my list later, and it also holds a very special sentimental place for me because when I was living up north, I was living in a place with no movie theater, but Annihilation was the first. I had traveled almost 300 miles to the nearest city just to like run some errands and stuff. But I made sure to see a movie, and Annihilation was that movie. So it has a lot of sentimental value to me too. But everything from the themes of this movie to the incredible visuals in this movie just make it so wonderful to watch.
Yeah, the visuals in this are stunning. They are absolutely flawless throughout. And I love that some of the shots in this movie and some of the scenes actually have the feeling of when you go to a Best Buy or something like that to buy a new TV, and they're playing that music, and it's just images of nature. Look how beautiful everything is. Isn't this fantastic? And that's how this looked. Some of the shots of the cabins and the plants that look like humans. It's so beautifully done. And it leaves you questioning, is that real? Is there CGI enforced in there? Is it just that they're shooting it in 1080 or whatever is higher? I don't know. I'm not that kind of film person. But what is it that makes that happen? And there are so many just gorgeous, gorgeous shots and scenes in this movie.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really like that that's the approach that Alex Garland took to this film. That he decided that the visuals were such an important aspect of it that that's what had to be emphasized and everything. Because there are some very jarring scenes in this movie. You have the swimming pool scene, for instance. Have you ever seen a more beautiful corpse?
Mm-hmm. I know.
And it's just like Garland's approach to having everything seem so recognizable yet so out of place at the same time really just makes you feel like you're in the Shimmer yourself.
Yeah, I agree. There's something about this movie that doesn't necessarily feel like sci-fi, which is difficult to pull off in a sci-fi movie. Because, you know, the problem with science fiction movies, and, you know, Annihilation wasn't a massive box office success. Ex Machina was, I think Ex Machina had done better. I don't think the reviews on Annihilation were great at the time, but I think in retrospect, it's, you know, woken up a little bit. But the problem with a science fiction movie is people will tune out. We talked about musicals last week when we talked about Cabaret and how if you're not discovering a musical at a young age, unless you're really into musicals like you are, you might not discover them ever. And that's kind of the problem with science fiction is if you hear it's science fiction and you're not into science fiction, you don't like Space Odyssey, you don't like a movie like Interstellar that comes out more recently and is a blockbuster. If you don't like those kinds of movies, you might say, well, I'm done with this. I'm not even going to give it a chance. But at the end of the day, this is a movie just about what ifs. And I think that's what he does a very good job of is it doesn't feel like the type of science fiction where here come the aliens and all that. You're really in something that is recognizable as Earth, but everything is just being changed enough that you're saying to yourself, what is going on in this movie? And I think he just does a phenomenal job of balancing that.
Yeah. And it's really a shame that this movie was such a bomb. This was a box office bomb. There's no other way to put it. I think it only made about 20 million or something like that.
I'll look that up right now.
But it received very negative views. It came out in February of that year, and I think it was still losing the box office to Black Panther at the time.
Okay.
So it was really overlooked. It was kind of pushed under the shadow. And while it is based on a novel, it's not really based on a novel because Alex Garland read that novel once and then wrote the script from memory afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, so there are just those differences between the original book Annihilation and the movie, but I almost think that's what makes this movie so beautiful because it is really just an Alex Garland sci-fi with these inspirations taken from this novel.
Yeah, so I'm looking at it right now. It was released February 23rd, 2018, and then digitally on March 12th, 2018 by Netflix. And Garland wasn't happy with that. Now, when you get a day and date type thing like that, that's not quite a day and date, but that's not very much time. It's going to cause, you know, not a great box office success. And when I look at somebody like Alex Garland, I always ask myself, is he kind of going to go the way of Charlie Kaufman? You know, where Charlie Kaufman was as hot as could be from 1999 to 2004, made three of arguably the greatest movies ever made, follows it up with Synecdoche, and nobody gave a crap. And I go through and I look at the movies that Alex Garland has written. And yes, I'm pulling it up on my phone because I don't have that great of a memory. But he writes the novel for The Beach. The Beach doesn't do well, but still, you know, doesn't do well critically, but still gets people notice it. Mm-hmm. Does 28 Days Later, Sunshine, Never Let Me Go, which if you've never read the novel for Never Let Me Go, check it out. Great novel. And the movie itself, it hits the emotion, even if it's not necessarily anything more. Does a good screenplay for Dread, then does Ex Machina, finally gets to direct, does Annihilation, and finally gets to direct. And now it's been, he's doing a mini series and all of that. And now he's got Halo in the works. But is there going to be enough of an audience, or is he just going to be deemed as one of those people that has diehard fans who are saying he's one of the greatest of all time, but others who just can't support him enough so that he keeps getting his movies made? Because this is a big budget movie. This is like a $50 million movie.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. And that's why it was so awkward that it was this bomb, because it was an expensive movie to make. And then when it comes to Garland, because he is always going to have that form to make his movies, I think. But it's like you were saying earlier, it's a sci-fi movie, so it's always going to be hard for him to find his audience. He's going to have his audience no matter what, but it's going to be hard to branch out beyond that audience.
When you think about a movie like Ex Machina, which really isn't even sci-fi at all. I mean, it's Oscar Isaac, it's Domhnall Gleeson, and then you have what do you call it? Alicia Vikander, who ends up winning the Oscar that year for a different movie, but she was hot for that. You know, that was a movie that really got her on the scene, and then she ends up winning with The Danish Girl, but people kind of felt that she was winning because of Ex Machina, because of that clout that she had garnered. Mm-hmm. It was really just a movie about three. It was about two people who make a robot. That's really all that movie's about. And yet still, like, how do you explain to people that this isn't that? Because when I sit down and I watch Annihilation, I almost view that as a war movie. That, to me, feels like a war movie. Now, is it a war movie the way that Edge of Tomorrow, another science fiction war movie, is a war movie? No, it's not like that. But this is about soldiers and chemists and biologists and all of that going in to fight something that they know is killing their own, or at least not allowing them to come back. And you know, I think it does a great job of balancing the beauty with the disgusting. And you know, yeah, there's sci-fi, there's a talking bear that is speaking as a dead woman in this movie, but for the most part it's very grounded in a specific type of reality, even if it isn't necessarily our reality.
Yeah, and speaking of that bear, it might be one of the most terrifying science fiction monsters of all time. Mm-hmm. The speed that it sneaks up and gets... Not that one, the first one.
Oh, yes, the first one, whose name I totally forget. She's the only actress in this movie who's not famous.
Yeah, and the speed at which the bear gets her, and then, you know, mimicking the voice and everything, it was terrifying. And I remember the promotional materials really showed that bear, and it's actually what caught my eye for the film in the first place, because I thought it was kind of like this sci-fi horror movie, and what we got out of it was so much better than a sci-fi horror movie. Yeah. But you raise a very good point where it is kind of like it has this war aspect to it, because really we're seeing everything through Lena's eyes, and Lena's how we get all of these connections to the world. And she's ex-military, but she's a biologist now. First and foremost, that's what she is now, is a biologist. But more importantly, she is a damaged human being. Just like every single one of the characters in this movie, they are all damaged, and that is so important for why they're being affected by the Shimmer.
Yeah, and I love the reveal that Jennifer Jason Leigh has cancer. Because we don't know it, and then at the one cut, it just says you had to have known. Well, I had guessed by then. It's so well done that off the top we hear about the three side characters, and I always call it, even though they are, you know, it's Tessa Thompson, phenomenal actress, Sheena Rodriguez, very good actress, Shepard, that's her name, but I don't know the name of the actress. But I almost look at them as red coats or red shirts, whatever they call them. Red coats, God, we're going back to the Revolutionary War, everybody. But the red shirts, where you know that they're going to die in this movie. You just don't know how. And you get the quick, you know, she cuts herself, this one's whatever. You get the rundown, lost a child, all of that. But you don't know about Jennifer Jason Leigh's character. And she's the one who you're the most interested in, because you don't know, and because you can tell she's going to be some sort of mental adversary for Natalie Portman throughout this movie. And sure enough, she is. And I love the way that that's revealed. I really do appreciate the cutting back and forth in this movie, because we know right off the bat, Natalie Portman gets out. And we also know that Oscar Isaac got out. Is she like Oscar Isaac? Or is she really Natalie Portman? That's the question you're left with the whole time, because that's why you don't know if she's telling the truth or lying. But everything she says to that guy is the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's just her. Again, you have to take a bit of leniency with this because we do not necessarily have a reliable narrator, because the entire story is being told from Lena's perspective after the experience. Mm-hmm. So we don't know if this is actually Lena or if this is a duplicate. There are hints either both ways, but the big thing here is that we know Lena's damaged. We know that she had a failing marriage, that she was feeling incredibly lonely and isolated. So we don't even know if this is the actual Lena, how much of her recounting of the tale is actually accurate to what happens.
Yes, and I think that's a very good point. This movie lets you know that this is from a character's point of view. It's kind of like when we watched Fight Club last week. You know that whole movie's from Edward Norton's point of view. This is a type of movie where you might tune that out, because you're saying to yourself, oh, this is what's happening, and then she's telling the story of what happened. But don't forget, she's telling the story of what happened. And so while I'm saying everything's the truth, yeah, it's the truth because it's what we're seeing. However, at the end of the movie, her eyes are a different color. And you get that shimmer of something's in her DNA. And it makes you wonder, was it just a shooting spree? What did something kill all of them? Did this happen exactly how it did? Part of me thinks that it happens exactly how she says it did, because she's now what, like, I feel like this has happened every single time, except Oscar Isaac was the first one to get out. And when he gets out, it changes it. And then it's almost like, just like how it is evolving to try to perfect the human form. Now it's trying to evolve to perfect how it can get outside of the shimmer. You know, first it might be a team went in, we never heard back. A team went in, we never heard back. But every time it's probably making progress until finally we get, it was able to perfectly mutate Oscar Isaac. Now it was able to perfectly mutate Natalie Portman, and it's able to get inside of her almost. Like, it's just, you can tell that there's an evolution happening here.
But even then, we're still left wondering if, in fact, Oscar Isaac is a duplicate or not, because despite the fact that we see his character supposedly commit suicide with the phosphorus grenade and, like, his skeleton's there and everything, for all we know, that could be the duplicate based on that final bit of dialogue between him and Lena, where he's just saying, or she asks, you're not my husband, are you? And he's like, I don't think so. But that's the thing. It's, I don't think so. It's not a definite. And that's what makes good sci-fi. Good sci-fi should make you think about, I said it before when we were talking about Dark City and stuff, good sci-fi makes you look at the world around you now and makes you investigate things that are happening in the world. But another thing that good sci-fi does is it lingers. It leaves you with the questions at the end that you don't necessarily have the answer to, but need to go over all the evidence to see what the answer truly is. And then it's okay if you come up with your own answer that differs from other people's interpretation of it.
Yeah, because you could even say with that last line of dialogue that he's saying, I don't think so, because he doesn't actually know if Natalie Portman's the real one or the fake one. He knows, maybe he knows he's the real person, but he doesn't know. Because also you have to think about, why is it that Oscar Isaac suddenly heals? Kane is his name in the movie, but why is it that he suddenly heals after the shimmer dissolves? Is it because he's human, so he feels better? Or is it because all of that energy, or whatever you want to call it, from the shimmer has gone into him, and now he can start, like, now that the shimmer's gone, it's actually better, because now they can just start to become civilized on Earth? Like, we don't really know what the meaning is, but I agree with you, that is what makes good sci-fi. Good sci-fi always leaves you saying, what could have happened? Or it makes you want to call up somebody who has seen the movie and say, what in the world did I just watch?
Yeah, exactly. And it builds in this movie. It really builds, because it starts off, you have Lena explaining to, it was Benedict Wong, right?
Benedict Wong, yeah. Yeah,
yeah.
Explaining, I think he's unnamed in this movie as well.
I believe so. She's just explaining the story and stuff. And there are a few things that are hints through it. There's the glass of water, which obviously harkens back to, or which will further harken to when Kane comes back from the shimmer and he takes the sip of water and he's bleeding into it. So we don't see that from Lena, so we're unsure. But we're also told Lena's been gone for 4 months. Mm-hmm. So we have no idea. We're already disoriented in the timeline because we don't know when things are happening because the shimmer is distorting and is distorting time and space, essentially. And it distorts light beams and radio waves and DNA. So it is intentionally disorienting.
And what is it? Everything is refracted, right? That's how Tessa Thompson describes it. Everything is refracted. And refraction, it's all still there. It just looks different. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of what this movie is saying, where, okay, he's bleeding into the water and he starts having a seizure and it looks like he's dying. Is that because he's alien or is that because he's still human, but he has the shimmer in him? Same thing with Natalie Portman at the end. She doesn't bleed. But that doesn't necessarily mean she's human. It could just mean that, again, there's been better evolution by whatever creature it is. What I think is so good about this movie, too, is it focuses on those, on like the fauna and the flora. Mm-hmm. It focused on that. There is no alien in this movie. You could argue that the mimic, I don't know, I feel like there's definitely a name for that in the Annihilation community here. But the mimic at the end of the movie, you could argue that that's an alien, but really it's not. Really, it's some sort of, you know, it is a being, but it's not this, oh, it's this greater power or something. It's being created out of nothing. It's being created out of just that orb, and that's it. And so I like that it decided to focus, that they really did try to focus on what if something came and it was just able to change us, and it was just able to infect us in a way that it didn't alter us all that much. It just altered us enough.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's, again, part of this theme. Our major themes in this are loneliness, the inevitability of death, and self-destruction. Mm-hmm. And that is what the shimmer really sets in play here. And we see it through each of the red shirts that we were talking about earlier. Because the first one gets hit sudden, out of nowhere. It's a sudden departure, sudden death. Talking about the inevitability mortality there. We then get Gina Rodriguez, who's fighting against it, who's fighting against the things in the shimmer. And then we have Tessa Thompson, who walks out and accepts the shimmer and the changes it's making to her body and embraces it and becomes the plant person.
Yeah, exactly. And it's all these different ways of dealing with it. And Natalie Portman's character she kind of takes a little bit of all of it. You know what I mean? Like, she's against it, but she's for, like, she still wants her to be herself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like, when I watch a movie like this, there's so many scenes in it, you know, and that's ultimately what makes up a great movie to me. You got to have those scenes that resonate. When they're cutting the guy open and his insides are moving, that you never forget. When the bear is coming up the stairs talking, you never forget that. When Tessa Thompson even turns into a tree, you don't really ever forget that. And then at the end of the movie, this whole song and dance, this mirroring that's going on between Natalie Portman and the other, and even how that whole scene takes place with Jennifer Jason Leigh, Jennifer Jason Leigh, right? Not Janet Jason Leigh. Yeah, Jennifer Jason Leigh. I'm thinking of Janet Leigh now, but with the greatest uttering of a title in movie history with her Annihilation. It's just so obnoxious, but then it leads into all the colors and everything like that. And it's just, there's so many scenes in this movie that just don't leave you. Mm-hmm. And it really does leave me wondering when I look at, you know, how the reviews were on this movie and kind of how it fell to the wayside, is this just not a genre for people, or were they really that turned off by everything in between? Because I have a hard time finding flaws in this movie, and it's not on my top 100, and it's something I've seen three times. I have a hard time finding flaws that it seems so many others have found.
Yeah, I think a lot of it, I mean, I hate to say it, but it is a female-led cast. It's an all-female cast with the exception of a couple of very minor characters. Mm-hmm. And that is going to result in bad reviews from a lot of people.
Yeah.
As awful as that is. And I think a lot of it also came from fans of the book didn't like the fact that it wasn't a faithful adaptation of the book. Because, like, the title Annihilation takes on a very different context in the book. Book spoilers, if you guys are going to read this, just, like, skip past this next little bit. Mm-hmm. But in the book, none of the characters are named in the book. They're all just referred to as their occupations, and you're reading essentially a field journal by the biologist. And Ventress's character, the psychologist, has actually hypnotized everyone in the party. And annihilation is the kill word. It's the one where they to make them commit suicide.
Interesting. I don't think that would have worked in this movie. I think that's too many concepts going on.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just too many concepts. Yeah.
And this is already a movie that's kind of investigating some very deep topics and doing it in a very cerebral way. And that also turns people off.
Yeah. Jordan Alford just said it's not a palatable film for the common moviegoer, in my opinion, too heady. I do agree with that. I think that sometimes like movies like this, they can just be a little too much for people. And I think that another problem, and this is something we're going to talk about when I get into movies like The Revenant and things along those lines, is when you don't have distance from the movies, when they haven't existed for long enough, people are less likely to give them the benefit of the doubt. Mm-hmm. You know, I think about, you know, I always talk about Space Odyssey. No one liked that movie when it came out. Like, that movie was terribly received. And now if you say you don't like Space Odyssey, people look at you like you have two heads. I feel that that's the case with a lot of science fiction just in general. It's almost like you can't figure out, is this actually great sci-fi or is it just trying to imitate other things? But I will say that after watching Ex Machina twice and this movie three times, I think this is above and beyond a better movie than Ex Machina. I think Ex Machina is brilliant in its simplicity, but to me, it's a little too simple. This movie, to me, it just everything, and it just gets into those deep thoughts. And maybe in 10 years, this will be a movie where people say, you know what? You got to go watch Annihilation. That was a damn good movie.
I really hope so. And one of the nice things, one of the things that I really appreciated about this movie is also you can tell Garland got a lot of inspiration from Tarkovsky in this film. There are a lot of elements from Stalker just in like going into a zone, being led by having a small group of people being led into this zone and then discussing like their lives and these deeper themes. And then, of course, there's also a huge influence from Solaris in this film as well, especially in that last segment of the movie. And in all honesty, the last half hour of this movie is a damn near perfect movie.
Yeah, I love the last half hour. I mean, if that doesn't grab your attention with everything that happens in that last half hour, I don't know what needs to grab your attention. Maybe the stuff before that you could say, I'm not into it and all that. But when Oscar Isaac just walks into the house and she doesn't even think twice and he's just not even giving her anything, you can tell he's been through something. We just don't know what. And it's real. It's not some dream or anything like that. Like, this is really happening. Maybe you don't buy into that, something like that. Maybe you don't buy into the whole going in and maybe the biology stuff doesn't interest you. But I agree with you. That last half hour from the moment and that was another one that I said didn't mention, but when Oscar Isaac blows himself up with the phosphorus grenade and then the other Oscar Isaac walks out, that's something that sticks with you. I mean, that doesn't go away. And from that moment on, I don't know how you're not in, like, 100% invested in what's happening, because as weird as it is, it's wild. It's very wild, but it's very captivating.
And I also love the sound design throughout that entire segment as well. Mm-hmm. It's very non-traditional when it came to its sound, but it fit everything so perfectly. And the fact that the duplicate is literally just someone in a bodysuit, mm-hmm. and it's just this beautifully choreographed scene. And you can tell that's what's happened. This scene where the mimic's just replicating everything that Natalie Portman's doing is just this beautiful dance, mm-hmm. but horrifying dance at the same time.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, it's hard to watch, and there's almost times where it seems that the mimic is a step ahead of Natalie Portman, knowing what she's going to do before she even does it. There's some really, if you rewatch that scene, there are some really, really crazy moments in that where you're just like, wait, it's ahead of her. Hold on. It's ahead of her, you know, and that's pretty unreal. I mean, that's pretty awesome to see something like that. So yeah. But all right. What else you got for me on Annihilation before we move on to Atonement?
I think Annihilation is one of those films, and I actually do think Atonement's kind of like this too, where it just shows the importance of going back and seeing films that were missed and just the importance of finding content somewhere on the internet, hopefully on our podcast, of these movies that you know, you've heard of and you just want to check out, but you never got around to, because there are hidden genre gems out there. And I have a few of them on my list. You do as well. But this is one that was grossly overlooked based on when it came out and just poor marketing.
Yeah.
But it is an incredible science fiction film.
Yeah. I totally agree with you. I totally agree. Natalie Portman gives a great performance. All the women in this are fantastic, and Oscar Isaac plays it well too. And I mean, it's just, it's a really, really powerful science fiction movie. And every time I watch it, it gets better and better. It really does. And there's something to be said for movies like that, because it's not easy to get better and better on every watch. It's not easy to not feel stale. And this is one that doesn't feel stale. Mm-hmm. All right, let's move on to my number 88, which is Atonement. Came out in 2007, a movie that I find is often overlooked because of the year it came out. Came out in a year with No Country for Old Men, There Will Be Blood, Juno, which, although it has lost popularity for sure in recent years, was unbelievably popular at the time, between Ellen Page, and it was kind of this Jason Reitman big thing, but Diablo Cody took the world by storm because she was a stripper or something, and people were like, oh my god, strippers can write. It's like, yeah, I mean, yes, most people in Hollywood are doing a job they don't necessarily love as they're trying to become a writer or a director or something along those lines. But I do find, and you know, I will talk about the movie, I swear, but I do find that period pieces are often the most hated on genre of movie for no reason ever in the history of time. Because I feel that every time a period piece comes out, people go, Oscar bait, ignore it, and it just gets ignored, or people won't give it the time of day. No, it's just going to be, you know, because this did happen in the 90s. And so I will say that a movie like Sense and Sensibility gets nominated for Weddings and a Funeral. And even though Four Weddings and a Funeral isn't a period piece, it does have that still like costume drama type feel, because it's all taking place at weddings and funerals. And so Howard's End and The Remains of the Day, like all these movies where it was, we're all going to dress really nice. And most like these movies aren't going to do well at the box office, but we're going to nominate him for an Oscar because that's what they were made for. And I think that has really hurt period pieces later on, because they're not just Oscar bait for being made. A movie is not Oscar bait because it's good and they wear costumes. That's not Oscar bait. And I think that's what's so annoying to me, is a movie like Atonement is so well-structured from a directing standpoint, from a screenwriting standpoint, from an acting standpoint. The cinematography is breathtaking. There is so much to love about this movie, but it gets overlooked because it's, oh, it's just that British thing. They're going to wear costumes and they're rich. And that's, it's a love story. It's a period piece romance. We don't have time for it. But at the end of the day, this movie isn't a period piece romance. This is a period piece tragedy. That is what this movie is, and it gets so overlooked. And what makes me laugh, There Will Be Blood is a period piece. There Will Be Blood is a movie set in a period of time that is not the present. However, it has one of the great performances of all time, if not the great performance of all time, and it's Paul Thomas Anderson, so everybody will give it the benefit of the doubt. Joe Wright had done Pride and Prejudice before this, but still not enough. Keira Knightley was being typecast. James McAvoy had not quite come onto the scene, and Saoirse Ronan was an unknown. And unfortunately, this is the movie that wins Best Drama at the Golden Globes over No Country and over Michael Clayton and over There Will Be Blood. And I feel that it has become the least popular out of all of them over the years, maybe because of that, but also just because people don't talk about it all that much anymore.
Which is absolutely incredible when you consider A, how loaded this cast is. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't loaded back then because it was a bunch of newcomers, essentially. But you watch this movie today, and it's like, holy cow, this is a fantastic cast. Saoirse Ronan gives one of the most incredible performances you will ever see from a 13-year-old.
Yeah.
Ever. And it's just, he does fall into that period piece thing. And while there has been some respect on period pieces a few years later after this, when The King's Speech wins Best Picture, and other, because we had those period pieces in the 90s that garnered so much attention, people did start thinking, oh, this is Oscar bait. And I think also the fact that Joe Wright was coming off of directing Pride and Prejudice made a lot of people not really pay attention to the film. And it's such a shame. This movie is incredible. I was sitting there watching this, and I was just like, how has it taken me 14 years to actually sit down and watch this movie?
Yeah, and it was one of my favorite finds. Because when you know, of course, Oscar time rolls around, watch No Country, watch Juno, watch There Will Be Blood. My dad had me sit down and watch Michael Clayton. I had no freaking clue what the hell was going on. There's a lot of people who still don't know what the hell was going on in that movie. Eastern Promises, great movie. Another one that came out that year, saw that at the time. In the Valley of Ella, my dad liked Tommy Lee Jones, so we sit down and we watch that. You know, you go through all these movies. Into the Wild, you know, I'm Not There, Gone Baby Gone, American Gangster. These all came out in the same year. The same year. And I really do think that Atonement, that was the only one I had not seen that year when it came out. And I'm like 15 at the time. But, you know, this is when I was really starting to get into movies and really starting to think about, like, how can I do something with movies for my life? And this was the only one I didn't watch. And then I watched it 4 or 5 years later when I was in college, and I said, holy shit, why did I not watch this? And why did I not watch it? Because it's just a rom. But the way that they structure this story and the way they tell it from all the point of views is just so well done, because ultimately that is what this movie is about. This movie is about jumping to conclusions because of your own predetermined thoughts and your point of view on a situation, but you don't have all the details. Just like Saoirse Ronan doesn't have all the details of what James McAvoy and Keira Knightley are arguing about at the fountain, James McAvoy and Keira Knightley don't have all of the details about what Saoirse Ronan is going on in her life during that time. Mm-hmm. And I just think there's so much going on there. And this first hour this is the period part of the movie. And it is so unlike any other period piece that you're ever going to watch. It is just so well done, where it keeps looping in on itself and getting more and more into the mystery of how is this going to go wrong for these people? And everybody in this movie is innocent, with the exception of Benedict Cumberbatch. Every single person in this movie is innocent, with the exception of him. Because even Saoirse Ronan, why was she having her witness testimony as a 13-year-old or 11-year-old or 12, whatever she is, be the one? And it's just, she's not a bad person. But clearly this stuck with her literally her entire life.
Yeah, and that reveal at the end of the movie when we see Bryony as a senior citizen, and she's written just her 21st novel, and she's telling the story, and it's like, oh, wow, like, she is guilt-ridden by this completely. And you just kind of wonder, when did it strike her? When did she realize what she had done?
And to me, I think it's when the marriage happens between Juno Temple's character and Benedict Cumberbatch's character. I think when that happens, I think that's her realization of, oh my God, that was him. It wasn't James McAvoy. What did I do? And again, I'm terrible with names of characters until we get into like my top 10 or 15. So you're just gonna have to deal with actors' names, unfortunately, everybody. But I think that's when it finally hit her. And then it was, how can I fix this? And the answer was, there is no way to fix this because they're already dead. It's already over. And the fact that a fairy tale is created for them by her, and that's what we're really watching play out the entire time. The hints are there throughout that they never see each other again, that James McAvoy is going to end up dying the day before the Dunkirk invasion, that Keira Knightley isn't going to make it through this war, how she keeps seeming to avoid Saoirse Ronan's character. Mm-hmm. And even though it doesn't really seem like reasonable, but it's her creating the fairy tale version of two lives that she totally ruined because she just didn't understand what was happening in the moment. Pretty good movie for cancel culture. I'll say that. It's pretty relevant 14 years later. That's for sure.
Yeah. It. When I sat down for this movie, I had a vague idea of what it was about. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that the first segment of this movie leading up to Briney's accusation was going to be the first hour and 15 minutes of this movie. Mm-hmm. And I didn't realize it was going to be told in such a phenomenal way. And it's told like a story. It's told like a story where you're jumping around from different characters and seeing their perspective on things. And all the hints are there that this is what's happening the entire time. But until you know the ending, you don't really notice it.
Oh, and it's one of the most devastating mic drops in movies. In my opinion, it's really one of those moments where there's movies that make you cry. Atonement doesn't make me cry. And maybe it makes other people cry. But the way this movie makes you feel is as soon as she says the words, well, of course, that never happened, or whatever it is, that the way the woman who plays that role, too, the way she delivers the line is just unreal. But when that line is said, and all of a sudden you realize, oh, my God, they died. And you feel the blood rush from your head. Mm-hmm. And you feel your whole body just like, oh, no, come on. And that does not go away for the rest of the movie. And for me, it takes me about 20 minutes to recover from this movie every single time. And it doesn't bring me to tears, but it leaves you with that devastation. You know, I have a lot of movies like this on the list, like Blue Valentine and things like that. There's movies that'll make you cry, but there's other movies that are just going to leave you going, ugh, I feel awful right now. And this is one of those movies because her whole life was trying to atone for a mistake she made as a young girl. That ends up being such a massive mistake that gets two people killed and completely ruins her life as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's really interesting how Joe Wright frames it to make it very clear how important the different viewpoints are, and how just because something has the correct intent doesn't mean that everyone views it that way.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And Joe Wright was not nominated for the Oscar for this, for Best Director, which I think is an absolute travesty. Nobody really was. I mean, so Keira Knightley wasn't nominated. James McAvoy wasn't nominated. And Joe Wright wasn't nominated for this. And now remember, this is coming off the Golden Globes where it wins Best Drama. And this was still at a time where if you won the Golden Globe, you were pretty much considered the front runner for the Oscar. This was really around that time still. That didn't really start to fall apart until they started to make it more movies for the Oscars being nominated. But Joe Wright wasn't nominated for people like Jason Reitman and Tony Gilroy. And look, Jason Reitman does a very good job with Juno, but his direction is nowhere near what Joe Wright's is. And that tracking shot on the beach, and I'm sure there's some film buff out there who's going to say, well, Phil, here's where they made the edits. Here's where the cuts were. The tracking shot on the beach, I don't know if it's one shot or it's 50 shots that are made to look like one shot, is so unbelievably impressive with all of the moving parts and everything. That little scene alone should have gotten him nominated for Best Director. And yet somehow he comes out of this after all the decisions. And it just lets you know that half the time what the Academy is voting for, they don't even know what the hell they're talking about because they don't even realize what direction is half the time in these movies. And that the direction in this movie is so well done.
So that entire 6-minute scene is a single shot.
They had
1,000 extras for the Dunkirk evacuation, mm-hmm. and they only had them for one day. So Joe Wright shot it and they get the camera guy to get onto a golf cart to get the shot going. But that entire 6-minute sequence is a single shot.
He does not get nominated for Best Director.
No.
He does not get nominated.
It's easy. One of the best shots ever. It's an incredible scene. It really does capture how hectic and frightening it must have been on the beaches of Dunkirk.
It's absolute chaos. Absolute chaos. It really is. And I mean, it's just that scene to me makes the whole movie is great. But when you watch that scene, you say to yourself, this movie is special. There's a difference between being able to handle a period piece and handle all those dynamics and being able to handle action and that type of dynamic. He handles both of them perfectly in this movie. That whole entire scene on the beach, you get caught up in it. You feel like you're in it. I mean, with the guy walking around and seeing them all singing and then go down and you have the horses and they're shooting the horses and everybody, that's not right. That's not right. And just all of that. And nobody knows what's going on. And it's just, oh, how do you not look? And the Oscars are the Oscars. It is what it is. But Joe Wright, I think Joe Wright's an underappreciated director, because then what ultimately ends up going on to happen is he starts to make too many Hollywood movies. And then, you know, his own style, his uniqueness kind of falls off as his career goes on, because he starts making movies that, yeah, are Oscar bait. You know, The Darkest Hour to me is Oscar bait. That is an Oscar bait movie. And, you know, I feel that, you know, when they just let him run, he's one of the best. Unfortunately, they stopped letting him run. And we see the effects, because, man, what he's able to pull off with some of the filmmaking in this is just unreal. It's unreal.
I just keep going back to the end of that long take, where there is the cut and it has James McAvoy going inside and he's just standing in front of the French film. Mm-hmm. Like, to me, that's one of the most powerful moments of the entire movie. And it's when you know that nothing good's going to happen.
Nothing good is going to happen. I know. I totally, totally agree. So I do, giving all the credit to Joe Wright, I do want to talk about Saoirse Ronan, because I don't have another movie with her in it on this list. Do you?
I don't think so.
Okay. But I want to talk about Saoirse Ronan, because she has had such an incredible career, and it started with this movie. This was the beginning, and then she went on to do Hannah and Lady Bird. I mean, now she's just massive. I mean, now she's going to break Meryl Streep's record for Oscar nominee. Like, it's just gonna happen. She's unbelievable. She's every movie she's in, it works. Mm-hmm. And the one thing I will say for her, I'm a huge Keira Knightley fan. I love Keira Knightley. Anything Keira Knightley's in, I will go and watch. That's how much I love Keira Knightley, because she makes some bad movies, but I will still go see them. The thing is with Saoirse Ronan, I was watching His Girl Friday, mm-hmm. and Rosalind Russell, after His Girl Friday, said the reason that her career spanned 5 or 6 decades, whatever it was because she was never a sex symbol. She was never the most beautiful actress in the room. That doesn't mean she's not beautiful, but she was never the most beautiful actress in the room. If you look at what's happened since Atonement between Keira Knightley and Saoirse Ronan's careers, Keira Knightley was so typecast into this, she must be the apple of everyone's eye, the most attractive woman in the room, all of that. And Saoirse Ronan wasn't. And that's not saying Saoirse Ronan is not gorgeous, because she is. But she never got into that. And that's why she comes out in movies like Brooklyn and Lady Bird and Little Women, where she can just be an everyday normal person. And while Keira Knightley, as Jordan Offer saying, is super underrated, and I will watch everything she's in, her career is starting to kind of vanish, because she's aging. That's what people do. People age. Saoirse Ronan, though, I do not see her career going that way. Because she is that Meryl Streep type, where unbelievably good looking, but she's not being pigeonholed into that. And her acting talent at the age of whatever she is in this movie is above and beyond what so many people can do, even when they're trained for years and years and years. And when you look at what she's done as compared to somebody like, I'm drawing a blank, Chloe Grace Moretz. Chloe Grace Moretz, hot as can be, and then it's like, eep. But Saoirse Ronan just keeps going up and up and up, because she's just one of the most talented actresses. I really do believe she's going to be the actress of our generation, and that's why I just wanted to throw all this in while I had my one chance to talk about her, because her performance in this was the only acting nomination for the movie. She ultimately ended up losing out to Tilda Swinton for Michael Clayton. Personally, I think Amy Ryan, Gone Baby Gone, was really the one to beat that year. But it just says like so much about Saoirse Ronan that she's getting nominated there and it hasn't gone away. It just has not. Instead, it's just gotten better and better and better every single year.
Well, that's the thing. She's 13 when this movie came out. So she's playing like the same age as her character. She's 13. She does this. Then she goes on to do A Winter's Bone after this.
Mm-hmm.
And then, yeah, she does
Hannah. The Lovely Bones. The Lovely Bones. Lovely Winter Bones, yes, with Jennifer Lawrence. Right. Yeah.
No. She's in the one with Jennifer Lawrence, I'm pretty sure. She's the other girl.
Oh, now I have to look. But continue.
And then she does Hannah. And then, yeah, she comes back with Brooklyn and Lady Bird and Little Woman. She's just being cast in these roles that have such a heavy weight. And part of it comes down to the fact that her performance in Atonement at 13 is incredible, because she is by far the best performance in that movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this is a 13-year-old taking on a very heavy role and a very difficult role to act. To have both the childhood innocence and then having it ripped away like Briony does is so hard for an experienced actor to portray. Mm-hmm. And you have a 13-year-old doing it.
I mean, even you believe entirely that she has a crush on Robbie. That's his name. It finally clicked. Yes. There it is. She has a crush on Robbie the entire movie, and she's jealous that Cecilia, look at it's coming back.
It's just all there now.
But that Cecilia actually has, you know, has his affection. She wishes that was her, and she knows it'll never happen because she's young, and that jealousy is ultimately what leads to her being too smart for her own good anyway at that young of an age. She's obviously brilliant, and her reading the note and not understanding it but thinking she does. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's what's even more heartbreaking as you watch the movie more and more is all of the little things about Juno Temple's character having the marks on her arm and Benedict Cumberbatch being as creepy as he is and all that. And there's some parts where Benedict Cumberbatch is overly creepy, but then there's other little hints where you're just like, watching all that and just saying to yourself, it's right in front of her. It's right in front of her, but she just couldn't see it. And you know that that's what this character in this movie does a very good job of capturing, that regret and that remorse that you then go on to live with for 70 years. Because you just totally cannot get rid of it. Ian McEwan's a sick man for writing such a thing. This is the guy who wrote the novel. So,
yeah. It's almost unfortunate how good Saoirse Ronan's performance is, because for me, it's the only thing that really took me out of this movie was the scenes of 17 or 18-year-old Briony instead. Mm-hmm. Just because it's like, but you're not Saoirse Ronan, and you're not doing as good of a job as Saoirse Ronan did here. You're doing a great job, but I'm sorry, Saoirse Ronan just kind of acted circles around you.
That's kind of the bummer of the whole thing, is like, it's not her fault. It's not her fault. It's just, she's being thrown in to an impossible spot. It's kind of like how I feel about Moonlight. Mahershala Ali's character is so good. And I know that he doesn't grow up. Like, obviously Mahershala Ali's character doesn't grow up, but as the kid grows up, the whole time I'm like, man, like, they couldn't have gotten Mahershala Ali for this role. They couldn't have gotten Mahershala, because he's just so good in the movie that I just want him everywhere. And he's only in the brief part, just like how Saoirse is in this movie. And that's the one thing that can be troublesome sometimes, is when your main character ages as much as she does. And she is the main character in this movie. Keira Knightley and James McAvoy are not the main characters in this movie, despite the fact that both of them could have and probably should have been nominated for Oscars in the leading categories. It's Briony's story, but it can't be totally Saoirse Ronan's story, because it would be totally weird to see her in makeup as an 80-something-year-old woman. That would be like, I don't know, watching Robert De Niro pretend he can kick the crap out of people when he's 80 and they're making him look like he's 30. That, you know, what do I know? I'm not Scorsese. That's just one of the things that stinks about it, is somebody had to fill in for that. And one of the best performances by a child, and I would consider anything under 16, I guess, to be a child, but one of the best performances by a child in a movie ever. I mean, she's just been on fire ever since. Brooklyn is one of my, what do you call it? Guilty pleasure movies. That's just one of those movies where, like, I can't really admit how much I love that movie, but I love that movie. So, all right, let's think about this. So we talked all about Atonement, all of that. What do you think the legacy of Atonement is? And is there a way, I know it's a little off topic, but I've seen this movie so many times, is there a way for Joe Wright to kind of get back onto the path of not just making the Oscars happy, but also blowing our minds, kind of the way, and even Pride and Prejudice, incredibly well done movie. Is there a way for him to get back to that, or is he just kind of off on his own now?
he almost all of his movies after this starred the people who are in this movie. He works with Keira Knightley nonstop because he also did Anna Karenina with her as well.
Yep.
And then, of course, he did Hannah, which had Saoirse Ronan in it. I think he needs to go back to finding the lesser-known actors and using them instead. Because I think we talked about Oscar bait a lot today. And I think Oscar bait, it's hard with period pieces because I do think Joe Wright does do period pieces very well. Mm-hmm. But it's hard with period pieces that if you have this very top billeted cast, people are going to associate the movie with Oscar bait and they are going to write it off. And the fact that something like Little Woman last year wasn't really billed as Oscar bait, despite the fact that, you know, it's a popular story, it's a period piece, and the cast for that movie was phenomenal. You just have to kind of capture it in a way where it doesn't come across as disingenuous. Yeah. And I think that's what's the problem with Joe Wright's later films, is that they are coming off as disingenuous, and they aren't really reflecting a vision the way Atonement did, or the way Prejudice even did.
Yeah, and I was just looking up what he has, and Jordan Alford beat me to it. He has a film coming out this year. I don't think it's a period piece. He's doing one for Netflix called The Woman in the Window, which stars Amy Adams. It kind of seems like a Rear Window type deal. And then he's also doing Cyrano. I never know how to say that, but off of the Cyrano de Bergerac. I have no clue how to say that, even though I've seen those words 5 million times. So it seems like he's going out of it, and he's going right back into it. You know what I mean? So, but it's what he does well. And I almost feel like once he did Pan and Anna Karenina and The Soloist, he got too big for his own good. And it's not his fault. It's just the studios saw somebody that, hey, we can kind of like mold his movies more than, because he's a very easy director to mold. While his style is phenomenal, he makes movies that every producer in Hollywood goes, oh, I know how to make that better. And then they make it like shit. But they always think they know how to make it better. And that is the problem with what Joe Wright does. He's not the David Lynch, Stanley Kubrick, PTA kind of guy where it's just so out there that a producer goes, you know what? Just call me when the movie's over and I'll get back to it. He makes movies that everybody has an input on. And I think Pride and Prejudice and Atonement, the reason why they're his best movies is because it was kind of just allowed to be him. It was just allowed to be his type of whatever he wanted to do with it. And I don't know. Atonement just leaves me devastated. I love the performances. I love the direction. I think the war is perfectly balanced. And it leads into another movie that's going to be on my list, which is A Very Long Engagement, which is Jean-Pierre Jeunet, who came out with the movie beforehand. Told in a totally different style and more of a stylistic type version of this, but you know, same thing with war and how can we get back together? It's a powerful concept when it works. And Atonement is definitely one of the instances where it works, in my opinion.
One thing I did find really interesting when looking into this movie further, because it did win an Oscar.
It did win for
best score, which I think is wild because Johnny Greenwood's score for There Will Be Blood is one of the greatest scores ever written. But I do really appreciate how the score for this incorporates the typewriter.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And again, that's another hint that this is all a story.
She is writing it, and at the beginning, it's, okay, I'm writing my first scene. I don't really know what I'm doing. And then it's picking up pace. And now I'm in the groove, and here we go. She's making it all up.
Mm-hmm.
She's making it up. We were talking about unreliable narrator with Annihilation. We have a totally unreliable narrator in Atonement to the point that we know she's even suffering from dementia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's very good. And I do agree with you. Johnny Greenwood's score is amazing, but the score for this movie is so original that you can't argue too much when it wins. And as we're going to be talking about on tomorrow night, when we talk about our Oscars, the Oscars used to love giving a movie 10 awards, 11 awards, 12 awards. Now they love to give one to everybody. Let's be nice to everyone and let everybody play. And that started to happen around this time. And I think that's why a movie like Atonement wins this, just like the year before Alan Arkin ends up winning Best Supporting Actor for Little Miss Sunshine, which I think he deserved, but he wasn't even nominated for half the awards that came before that. And he goes on to win that because that was, it did win screenplay too, but it really didn't have many opportunities to win, and they love to be able to give something to something. And with Atonement, there was some backlash when this came out that Joe Wright and Keira Knightley and James McAvoy didn't get any nominations. And that really was kind of the place where it could win. You know, I don't know what, I mean, obviously cinematography was won by There Will Be Blood. There is no arguing that one. It was also nominated for art direction, but that went to Sweeney Todd. And again, they wanted to give Sweeney Todd something. Mm-hmm. They wanted to give it something. So it wins that over There Will Be Blood, Atonement, and American Gangster. So whatever. Whatever. All right. All right, John. We've gone through two movies that start with the letter A. That's what they have in common. And boy, is that exciting. Next week, we are going to be moving on to our number 87s. And oh boy, I am not prepared. So next week, we're going to be moving on to our number 87s. I'm going to hold.
It's okay, no, I have it now.
Well, I already got it.
Oh, okay.
Jackie Brown for John and Stand By Me for me. I like this. We just went from the 2000s to now we're going a little bit older. Probably Quentin Tarantino's least popular movie. And I think a childhood classic, a movie about just friendship. And I one of the best movies about childhood, in my opinion. So two movies that are, again, different. And Samuel Jackson in Jackie Brown is going to say some things that is going to make your head go boom. But he is so damn good in that movie. Based on the novel Rum Punch, which wasn't very good, in my opinion. But Quentin Tarantino put his spin on it. And it's Jackie Brown's a hell of a thing. But as I said, John and I, even more recently than that, tomorrow night, we're going to be going through the Oscars. We're going to go through every single category. We'll run through a lot of the smaller ones. I haven't seen the short films. I haven't seen the short documentaries or any of that. But we are going to still give our opinions because, hey, let's be real. We're all happy the Oscars are happening, even though it's been very delayed. You're probably going to want to be doing some sort of pool where you print it out and you check it off, even if it's for beer or for candy. Who knows? You're going to be wanting to doing it with somebody. So those little categories are where you make or break it. We're going to go through all the categories, but we're really going to focus in on the bigger categories such as picture, director, acting all down the board, both screenplays, animated film, international film. And as I said, we'll do cinematography as well. And then as I said earlier, of course, sound, because Sound of Metal not winning that would be the biggest travesty. Probably since The Favorite not winning art, production design, which it lost to Black Panther. And you all can say what you want about Black Panther, but just look up Black Panther production design images and then look up The Favorite production design images, and wow, your mind will be blown on the difference between those two things. So anyway, tune into that tomorrow night. It'll be after our challenge finale recap, which I think the challenge ends at 9:30. So we'll be doing that from 9:30 to 10:30. And then John and I will be, this is Eastern time. John and I will be having a late night where we're going to kick Annabelle off immediately. And the two of us are going to go on and we're going to break it down. So probably about 11:15, 11:30, probably between a half hour, 45 minutes is what my guess is. John, anything I didn't say about Annihilation or Atonement that I should have said, or anything that you want to say to get everybody pumped up for tomorrow or next week?
No, but you guys have 24 hours to watch all eight of these films nominated for Best Picture, and there are some very, very good ones up there this year. We're looking at a decent year.
Yes, I agree. Good year. Everything so far that I've seen has been worth my while. I've seen all the best pictures. I've seen everything for best director. Not seen everything yet for actress or supporting actress. Those are the two I'm going to get on before tomorrow. And luckily, it's supposed to rain all day here in Florida. And I'm supposed to be working outside, which is not going to happen if it rains. So that's all I have for that. Everybody, keep on telling people about this. Share it. It seems like we had a pretty good night tonight in terms of viewers, so thank you all for tuning in. Jay Millsip on Letterboxd, PWood43 on Letterboxd. See what we're talking about, what we're watching. I just watched Borat 2 and despised it, so make sure to check that out. Movie that had some ideas and wasn't clever at all. You gotta be clever, guys. To me, it just felt like I was watching unfunny headlines being read. But anyway, go over so you can see our reviews. You can disagree with us. You can agree with us. Neither one of us cares. And we'll be back tomorrow night with our Oscar preview for the 2021 Oscars. Night, everybody.